The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, known as ANILCA, is a federal law that established how public land in Alaska would be managed. You could think of it as a massive zoning effort. Late President Jimmy Carter signed the act, putting more than 100 million acres of Alaska under certain protections. Development-minded Alaskans said ANILCA locked up land, and conservation advocates praised the set-asides. The act also worked to restore hunting and fishing rights for Alaska Natives and establish rural priorities for food harvesting during times of shortage. ANILCA is 45 years old. What do you know about the law, the controversy that surrounded its passage, and how Alaskans view it today? We'll discuss Jimmy Carter's conservation legacy in Alaska today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. President Jimmy Carter was known as a man of deep faith, humility, love of family, country, and the outdoors. The late president loved fishing and was an avid birder. Protecting and preserving natural areas for future generations was a priority for him, and ensuring access for all people was also important. Alaska wasn't the only place that President Carter created national monuments, parks, and other conservation set-asides. The National Parks Conservation Association notes that Carter signed 39 national park sites into law, including parks honoring Martin Luther King Jr., women's rights, and parks that give access to urban Americans. If you like the outdoors, as most Alaskans do, it all sounds swell, right? But in the late 70s, in the lead-up to the signing of ANILCA in 1980, some Alaskans were so angry they burned effigies of Carter and denounced what they felt was federal overreach. But for Alaska Native and all rural people, ANILCA's Title VIII restored subsistence rights and prioritized rural preference in times of shortage. And for conservationists and environmentalists, Carter was an icon and a visionary. The man put solar panels on the White House in the 70s. So, how does Carter's legacy look now compared to the fear and joy that his actions inspired? Here to help us understand the ongoing effects of ANILCA and other conservation efforts is Sally Gibbert. Sally is a retired ANILCA coordinator for the state, and she still conducts ANILCA trainings. We'll learn about that in a bit. Joe Nelson is on the line. Joe is an attorney and co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, AFN, board, and Joe is the current president of the Sea Alaska Company. He is Slinkit from Yakutat. Also with us is former ADN reporter Tom Kazaya. In addition to the Daily News, Tom has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, among others. His books include Cold Mountain Path and Pilgrim's Wilderness, about the history and people of the McCarthy area. Tom recently wrote a story, an obituary about Jimmy Carter's legacy in Alaska for the Daily News. And also with us is Pat Porchot. Pat worked for the Interior Department in the 1970s. Then he worked with Alaska's delegation on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, ANILCA, and other land use legislation. He is a former state lawmaker, having served in both the State House and Senate in the 1980s, and a former commissioner of the state DNR. Welcome, all of you. All right, so to get us started off here, Sally and Pat, I'm going to turn to you. For Alaskans who were not here when ANILCA was passed or were maybe too young to remember it, describe both how sweeping this legislation was in creating new parks and wilderness areas and the political tensions surrounding it. Sally, do you want to start us off with the sweeping nature? And Pat, you can jump in for the drama.
Sure. First of all, ANILCA was kind of the capstone to three major pieces of legislation that took place in just over 20 years. So the map of Alaska went from virtually all federal land to the sort of the carve-up that it is now with, you know, state, native, federal conservation areas. All that framework was put in place in an incredibly short period of time. So starting with the Statehood Act, the Native Claims Settlement Act, and then ANILCA. And ANILCA was actually teed up by the Native Claims Settlement Act, when the conservationists were looking at all these selections by the state and the natives that were coming along and, you know, millions of acres and going, ah, we need to set aside some for conservation. So so the genesis for ANILCA derives from Section 17D2 of the Native Claims Settlement Act. And so consequently, all that discussion about what was going to happen next was referred to as, you know, the D2 lands or the D2 bill or the D2 legislation, which eventually became ANILCA. So that's that's the biggest picture framework. And then within that, there was, as you note, a huge amount of controversy around that. You know, how much lands would be in conservation system units, what type they would be, whether they would be park or forest or preserve or refuges, wilderness. You know, those were all those. That was all on the table. Everything was on the table.
And all very different.
Yeah, all very different.
Designations.
Right,
yes,
yes. Yes. And then on top of that, you had, you know, what kind of accommodations there would be, because it was looking like it was going to be a lot of land, more than was anticipated in Section 17D2. So it was going to have a lot of impact on people. So how to mitigate some of those impacts yet still provide for a conservation purpose. Mm-hmm. So therein is the 181-page bill, mm-hmm. law, which then sets up a whole ton of kind of conditions or caveats or special exceptions to try and make this work for Alaska, including people that are living right in and around these units. So it's loaded with compromises.
Yeah. Pat, pick it up there, please.
I came up to Alaska in 1972, immediately following passage of ANCSA, which, as Sally described, contained the 17D2 language to study, withdraw and study up to 80 million acres for new parks, refuges, and wild and scenic rivers. And I and several other people from around the country came to Alaska, and I had one of the greatest jobs in the world working for the Department of the Interior, looking at potential wild and scenic rivers around the state, and traveling around and floating rivers at government expense. And but that effort led then to legislative proposals in the mid and later 70s that were submitted to Congress for consideration. And as Sally mentioned, there's 3 years literally of debate and consideration of various bills setting aside land for conservation in Alaska, and not without a lot of controversy, and then finally ending with passage of ANILCA in 1980.
And we'll talk about some of that as we that tension as we move forward. And Tom, please describe what you saw and heard from Alaskans during your reporting on the lead up to the passage of the act. Some people were really steamed up by it.
I know there was a lot of apocalyptic rhetoric, but one of the things I remember was was it 77 or 78, the Interior Committee had some hearings in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and the sort of shock headline was that half of the people who showed up to testified in favor of the wilderness bills, really kind of turning the tables on the political leadership up here. I was writing for the Homer News, and I wrote about it for the Alaska Advocate. But the first story I ever wrote for the Anchorage Daily News, I filed from Don Young's office on the night ANILCA passed. I was living in D.C. for a year. And really, the mood that night in Young's office was kind of celebratory and relief, even though they'd been sort of battling against D2 for a long time. They were glad that it was done. And also they had, the politics there was that when Reagan was elected in 1980, everything kind of shifted, and the stronger conservation bill was set aside, and the one that the Alaska delegation had been pushing was the one that was finally adopted. So I suppose there was some reason for champagne popping at that point. On those grounds, and also on the fact that the actual administration of the new law was going to be in the hands of Ronald Reagan and James Watt, and was expected to be much more friendly to industry in terms of interpreting how that law was going to unfold.
Mm. All right, thank you for that. And Joe, turning to you, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, extinguished hunting and fishing rights. Title VIII of ANILCA sought to remedy that. What was it intended to do? How did Alaska Native leaders consider Title VIII of ANILCA? Was it seen as a critical fix to the legislative extinguishment of hunting and fishing rights in ANCSA, or as a temporary Band-Aid until a better remedy was presented?
Yeah, thank you, Laurie. I guess I call it maybe a disadvantage at the moment, is that my firsthand knowledge comes from being 7 years old in Yakutat when Jimmy Carter was elected. And we barely had TV yet in Yakutat. So I don't have, like my colleagues here, so I'm in listening and learning mode on that. But I'm co-chair at AFN and a lawyer, and I've studied all these things. I definitely know today that it is known as a compromise that is not working. I don't think anybody really favors the dual management system that we're stuck in right now. And for the Native community, it continues to be the top priority and very much unfinished business. So although the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was a trigger that resulted in ANILCA needing to come into play, the fix was truly a compromise that is not working for the Native folks. So it continues to get debated every AFN convention on what that fix looks like. And I know we're going to get into that a little more here, but yeah, I would say it's very much front and center on all of our minds. It's the one unifying thing. There are 229 or so federally recognized tribes in Alaska right now, a lot of communities, a lot of corporations. But we're all fierce advocates of protecting our way of life, and the dual management system we're living in right now just really isn't doing us service.
All right, thank you, Joe. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the late President Jimmy Carter's legacy in Alaska. ANILCA is a big piece of that, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, a sweeping law that set aside more than 100 million acres in Alaska. On the line with us today is Tom Keziah. Tom is a former Anchorage Daily News reporter. Pat Porchot is also on the line. Pat is a former state lawmaker, and he worked for Interior and with Senator Mike Gravel on ANILCA. Joe Nelson is the co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, AFN, and the president of Sea Alaska. And in the studio with me is Sally Gibbert. Sally is a former state ANILCA coordinator and still teaches ANILCA, and we're going to learn more about that. So, Pat, we know that there was turmoil here in the state. Some people praised this effort when it was being bandied about. Others were afraid that it would lock up too much land. What was the tone in the Capitol during those days? Was there a lot of congressional fighting over the tenets of ANILCA?
There were people both in the House and Senate that were absolutely pushing for the conservation system units. Mo Udall, the chair of the House Interior Committee, and the Parks Subcommittee chair, John Seiberling, were very much keen advocates for lots of protections for lands in Alaska. Over on the Senate side, you had people like Senator Tsongas and Senator Cranston of California and others that were very much pro-conservation. But you also had Scoop Jackson leading the Energy Committee. And there was an interesting dynamic there. Jackson was in favor of conservation areas, but he was also keenly aware of oil and gas needs and development needs. And he also was, I would characterize, a close friend of Senator Stevens, who joined the Energy Committee during the consideration of the bill. And they worked well together. And I think that Jackson was trying to accommodate Alaskan interests in the bill, particularly along lines that he personally favored. And Senator Stevens was working for various protections, notably continued logging in the Tongass Forest, notwithstanding the designation of certain wilderness areas there. And he was able, Senator Stevens was able to put in guaranteed cut figures into the bill for the Tongass and authorize, not appropriate, but authorize. Big money, $40 million annually for pre-commercial thinning and roading and things to bring into the to assist in continued logging in the in Southeast. So you had this balancing of issues. Senator Gravel, the other senator from Alaska, was probably supportive of, you know, more modest parks and refuges, but did play quite an obstructionist role at certain points in time, stopping the bill or trying to stop the bill from passage. There was also in Washington at the time a fairly big lobbying effort on many sides. There was a group formed in Alaska, CMAL, Citizens for Management of Alaska Lands. They played a big role in lobbying for development interests in D.C. You had guides and the people like the Safari Club arguing for not putting prime big game areas, particularly Dall Sheep areas, into parks. That resulted in some boundary adjustments for park preserves adjacent to areas like Wrangell, St. Elias Park, that were sport hunting was continued and guiding was permitted. AFN was very much involved in DC, had DC lobbyists and people working subsistence and other particular deals, if you will, for certain corporations. Admiralty Island, for example, Kootsnahoo, the native corporation there was very much in trying to structure a land deal where their lands would not be cut, but maybe they'd get in lieu selection rights elsewhere. So there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of things were going on. Mining companies were keen on protecting some areas of known significant mining, like Quartz Hill outside of Ketchikan for molybdenum, like Greens Creek on Admiralty Island near Juneau. Interestingly enough, Quartz Hill was never developed, even though it was carved out of Misty Fjords Wilderness. And Greens Creek, of course, did result in an active mine. So lots of
turmoil,
advocacy on all sides.
Yeah, it's
and Laurie, I would say, you know, up against pushing all of this along was this big national environmental wave on the other side that it's almost hard to contemplate today to realize how coming out of the 60s and early 70s, the first Earth Day, there was such a national movement at its peak. And really, when you think back, they had to pass the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and create the EPA. There was a lot of things that weren't being taken care of in those days. And that had created this national movement, which then kind of culminated in the push to, quote, save Alaska. The coalition of environmental groups that was pushing this along ran what was credited as a kind of masterful campaign of going into individual house districts and using the local conservation movement there to push their Republican or Democratic representative to vote for the Alaska Conservation Bill. And it was kind of the famous, what they called a cheap environmental vote, because in most cases, they didn't have any constituency that was really pushing against the conservation bill in their sort of local economy. And so it was a great way for everybody in Congress to sign up on, for the Earth Day movement by saving Alaska.
All right. Well, that...
I was going to add...
Go
that,
ahead, Sally, yes.
Yeah, just in some people say that... the efforts by the Alaska Coalition kind of invented a so-called grassroots organization figuring out how to take national issues and make them important to people locally.
Let's go to the phones for just a moment. William is in Fairbanks. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to speak on the subsistence portion of ANILCA, because it was very critical for our rural communities to get those subsistence provisions passed in ANILCA, and they were opposed by most of the state people and also Senator Stevens and even some of the corporate leaders at the time. And so there was a group of us from various organizations. I was with Panama Chiefs at the time. Jonathan Solomon was on my board. Carl Jack was the head of ABCP, the Bethel organization of all the tribal governments there. And so we were lobbying for the inclusion of this subsistence provisions because we didn't trust the state government. We knew that if it was a state issue, which they tried to push forward, that they would get rid of it. So we wanted federal oversight. And one of the major people that worked with us was Bertram Hirsch, a New York attorney. And we were lucky. We got it passed because Senator Stevens tried to pass the ANILCA provisions without, you know, under unanimous consent. But at the time, you could stop unanimous consent with an objection by another senator, which we got. And then Senator Stevens finally started negotiating with us so we could get the provisions passed. Udall was also very instrumental in assisting us. Some of the leaders, Byron Millard, Oliver Levitt, Morris Thompson, they'd already sold us out and had negotiated with Stevens to get ANILCA passed without the subsistence provisions. So I think Bertram Hirsch, a New York attorney, is very critical in this discussion. So if you could contact him, I think you'd gain a lot of insight in how this legislation included the subsistence language.
Well,
thank you very much for including me in your talk. Do you have any questions?
Well, thank you so much, William. I want to give our guests a chance to react to your comments now, but really appreciate the call. Thank you for that context that you provided. Pat, reflect back on what William was talking about in relation to Stephen's objections to Title VIII.
I am trying to think back, reflect at that time. And again, keep in mind the legislation was considered over several years, so positions kind of shifted over that time. I think initially, the caller from Fairbanks is correct that Senator Stevens was not supportive of a priority that discriminated among Alaskans. And of course, there were subsequent court cases after ANILCA passed. Challenging the subsistence provisions. The Alaska Supreme Court agreed with plaintiffs in one of those cases that absent a state constitutional amendment, that the state was not able to discriminate among Alaskans in terms of the taking of hunting and fish and other resources in the state. And then that, of course, set up a whole other effort in the legislature to pass a constitutional amendment that would allow the state to continue management of all fish and game resources. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, this dual system continues today of state and federal management of fish and wildlife.
Yes.
On various lands, state lands, federal lands throughout Alaska.
Thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones for a moment before we take a break at the bottom of the hour. Gabriel is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello.
Did you have a question or a comment, Gabriel?
Yeah, I had a comment and a question if you're able to answer. ANCSCA happened before my time, but it was very involved with my grandfather and my father. And then what I remember from them talking about is that when it happened, they had banned any further human occupation in ANWRF, the Alaska Native Wildlife Refuge, which is in the upper northeastern part of Alaska. And then with all this new talk about our president-elect coming to say that he's going to come and open it and drill it, what I'm wondering is all those protection stuff, all the bills that they passed back in the 1980s when ANCSA happened and they had this land protected, why are they able to go back on their word and open it when human drilling means years and years of exploration in the land equals human occupation?
All right, Gabriel, thank you for the call. I do want to make a correction here. It's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So ANWR is Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Sally, do you have an idea of how to consider answering Gabriel's concern here?
Yes. First of all, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is very large. And it was initially established before ANILCA, so 1960, which set it aside as a refuge. So from that point on, in terms of land ownership, you could no longer own land within the refuge. And then when it was expanded by ANILCA, that expanded that limitation. So that's correct that you can't live there, you can go there and do things, but you can't like just live there and get land. I think he's referring to the coastal plain, the coastal plain,
1002.
The 1002 area. Yes, very good. the coastal plain, which is the small but very important part of the northern part of the refuge. It's up against the Arctic coast. And that's where all the action is in terms of oil and gas. And in 1980, Congress could not decide what it wanted to do with the coastal plain. So it very specifically punted that issue to the future and set up a study area. They did not designate it wilderness. You know, they said, okay, we don't know what to do with this. Go study it and then let us know what to come up with, and we can always change that. So Congress kept for itself that decision on whether it was going to open it or not. And there were lots of studies, lots of recommendations, all of which are kind of in the long run irrelevant. It's what Congress wants. So Congress didn't do anything to it until the, I can't remember the bill in 2017.
One of those big acts,
yeah. You know, where these things get stuck in. Anyway, so Congress in 2017 did say, okay, yes, we want to see some exploration and we want to see two lease sales. So Congress did act. They did say that. So, and then, of course, the administration of that and the implementation of that through several different competing administrations where they take different approaches on how to do that, which is a whole another controversy. That's where that's at now. So it's Congress did say, yeah, it's OK to develop it.
Wow, you boiled that down so quickly, Sally. Thank you so much. We are going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the late President Jimmy Carter's legacy in Alaska, which is in a large way ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Talk of Alaska will continue statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing today ANILCA. It's 45 years old, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which was a big part of Jimmy Carter's legacy in Alaska. On the line with me today is Tom Kazaya. Tom is a former Anchorage Daily News reporter. Also on the line is Pat Porchot, former state lawmaker who worked for Interior and with Senator Mike Gravel on ANILCA. And Joe Nelson is on the line with us. Joe is the co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, AFN. And Joe is an attorney, and he's the president of Sea Alaska. And in the studio with me is Sally Gibbert. Sally is a former state ANILCA coordinator and still teaches on ANILCA. We're going to learn about that in just a few minutes. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Tim is in Haines. Hello, Tim.
Hello, this is Tim Ackman calling from Haines. I'd just like to do a couple comments here on ANILCA and ANCSA. I'll start with ANCSA first, but I was in 1971 when the news came out that there was in fact, settlement. And the assimilation of all the indigenous groups and peoples here was part of that, and had to join an economic workforce. Also, with a settlement check that the first one came out was pretty interesting. But in the 50 years since the inception of this act, a lot of the people in the whole state of Alaska, the natives, have a high rate of loss and no gain in the Angska deal. And it's poverty level is what we call it. We all pretty much live under that. And it's real interesting to see. And then again, you know, poverty pretty much rules the roost. And in the Angska Act also, they took away all our rights, the fish and game and everything else, the land included, the corporations got that. We don't have, you know, opportunity to sell fish. That was our right in the beginning. So, yes, it's interesting. But, you know, and then the Anilka Act, it's good to have protection, but when, like they, one caller said in that they disregard the rule in the under Anilka for protection of the lands, and it just kind of locked everybody out, you know, in a sense. But yeah, any action is good. So that would be my comments. And
all right.
Thanks for the show.
Thank you, Tim, for the call. I want to stay with the phones for a moment. Let's go to Roger and Douglas. Hello, Roger.
Hello. I was, I'm a lifelong Alaskan, born back in territorial days. I'm also part native and grew up in rural Alaska. As an adult, I was a reporter and then later became staff to the legislature and was the leading staffer when the subsistence bill actually passed the legislature. It was later struck down by the state Supreme Court. And it leads us to where we are today with dual management on federal lands. And it's really too bad that that law was struck down, because I worked side by side with Alaska Federation of Natives, and AFN gave tremendous relief to non-native Alaskans in the language of that bill. The current management system is horrendous.
Well, Roger, thank you. I want to get Joe in here for a moment, because we've had some comments from the last couple of callers about, you know, critical of ANCSA and the lockup that happened there. And then hearing also about the work that AFN did in those earlier days. Joe, what would you like to respond here?
Yeah. Thank you, Laurie, and to Roger and Tim and the others, William. As my earlier comment was that the dual regime, everybody agrees it's not working. And the major impediment, which we're all aware, is the Alaska Constitution. And folks need to understand that the Alaska Constitution has been amended 28 times, not in the last, you know, 20 years or so, but it's been amended 28 times. And there were a lot of efforts to have the fix and achieve the fix, which the fix really was a compromise on the rural preference. So to really right-size this thing, it would be to focus on, you know, true local, true tribal, true Alaska Native priority, the way it was meant to be, because to separate natives from the land, from the management of the land, really just is kind of nonsensical to us. Even with the corporations that hold fee simple title, it's the state that has jurisdiction over those lands. So the corporations can't even really manage their own lands for wildlife and our traditional hunting and fishing. So the Great Compromise has really got us at a standstill for the last 20 plus years with the last efforts to amend the Constitution or to have any real legislative fix happen. So my belief is that within the next few years there will be some type of movement to go ahead and to have ANILCA either amended and truly have federal preemption to protect the rights of the natives, or a state constitution, to strike the balance here and have the rural preference or a rural plus. So there are all kinds of proposals out there that have been floated. They got very close back in the late 90s to accomplishing it. But we just haven't had the leadership, in the state to pull together, like we that was talked about earlier, all the competing interests to get on the same page and align around the priorities here. So yeah, the speakers are right that there's very much a problem with the whole system right now that we'll continue to wrestle with until we amend the Constitution or have federal law preempt state law.
All right. Thank you,
I
Joel,
would.
for that
I w
feedback. And I want to let Sally jump in here for a second. Sally, you wanted to comment.
Oh, this is in response to a comment about a native preference as intended. And that Congress in ANILCA very much chose not to go with a native preference. It is a rural-based preference. I mean, there's a lot of recognition of the importance of subsistence to Alaska Natives, and I don't think there's any pushback against that. but the law itself is not race-based, and there's no administrative way to change that without going back to Congress. And that and the Alaska Constitution, that there's that would be a I wouldn't see that that would be a that'd be a tough one to I don't think the state's set up to do a native preference.
Well, here's a question that I have, and Pat, I know you wanted to get back in here, and Joe mentioned that it would take either, as we know, an amendment to the state constitution to comply with the federal mandates of ANILCA or an amendment to ANILCA. But with the incoming administration that is focused on resource development and that sort of those sorts of ideas and forward-looking plans for the country and possibly Alaska, would it be dangerous to consider amending ANILCA right now, or what would you think about that, Pat?
Well, that was as Joe alluded to, and I think Roger did, that was kind of a consideration during this revisiting of the subsistence issue by the state legislature in the 80s that carried forward into Governor Knowles's term as governor in the early 90s. And various combinations were being considered with a state constitution and then a package of amendments to ANILCA. I think you alluded to it, Lori. One of the big concerns was you start getting into ANILCA, and there's lots of things that lots of people would like to change there. And there was a fear of opening up what was kind of a compromise at the time. That was a real issue. The legislative component for the state constitution, that was, as Roger alluded to, that was very acrimonious for a number of years. I was in the legislature at the time and then worked for Governor Knowles, where that attempt was continued. And even though there were sometimes the House would pass and the Senate wouldn't, and sometimes the Senate passed and the House wouldn't, it was people felt very strongly against a rural, even a rural preference, let alone a native preference, for the taking of fish and wildlife. I would just add one more thing. Looking back, 40 or 50 years is always tough. It was a You have to keep in mind the time frame there. It wasn't just development-minded conservatives that were not in favor of a native preference at the time. there was a kind of a change in attitude based on the not very good examples of Native reservations, Indian reservations outside. Congress, a lot of the Congress at the time, were very unhappy with the reservation model, with the Native preference for things. And that led to first the establishment of corporations rather than reservations under ANCSA. And then in the consideration of subsistence, it was very unpopular and not really given consideration much by the Congress back in the 70s for strictly a Native preference in the subsistence provisions.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want Joe to weigh in there on some of those differences between the systems in the lower 48 and what was created here in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing Anilka and Jimmy Carter's legacy in the state. Joe, I want you to comment quickly, and then I want to get to some other land use issues. But Pat was talking about what Congress was looking at the reservation system in the lower 48 and wasn't happy with what was happening. When you look at the system, reservations in the lower 48 and in Canada, and compare it to the system of regional and village corporations here that came out of ANCSA and Anilka, what do you think Congress did well for Alaska, and what do you wish had been different?
Well, I'll try to keep it quick, Lori. Pat's right in the sense it was a reaction to what has been happening. Treaty making ended in 1871. 100 years later, we had the settlement in Alaska with Alaska Natives across the board there, but that settlement was been amended many, many times. So like many laws, you have to keep going back and fixing it, retooling it, refining it, and ANCSA has been amended many times just to have what we have right now. So it's all been compromise after compromise. And the thing that's actually was a glimmer of hope these last 2 years was having our first Alaska Native representing us in Washington, D.C. Because Alaska Natives are not all on the left or not on the right. We're not going to be conservation refugees. We're not going to be all with the big industry. We're kind of the common sense in the middle that's going to be here forever, no matter what administration is here. So we just need to be leading the way because we're all about balance, and every decision we make inherently takes in the count future generations. Mm-hmm. We're just all about our grandkids and having our grandkids be able to live just like our grandparents did. So there's a lot of common sense in just, letting the locals who happen to be Natives be the ones at the head of the table.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Sally, talk a little about how Anilka sort of rewrote the rule book for National Park Service in Alaska and the distinctions between what's here and what's in the lower 48 system.
Sure, I can do that. First of all, subsistence is one of those. We covered that. the so-called conservation system units that were set up include parks, refuges, wilderness areas, wild and scenic rivers. There are a number of those. It's a whole collection. And most of those collectively called conservation system units or CSUs. Anilka has many, many provisions which change how they're managed with the lower 48. There's a whole set of access provisions that for access for traditional activities, and there's special access provisions for subsistence where you can have for both traditional activities and for subsistence for traditional purposes. You can use things like snow machines, for example. That's usually the headliner, the one that attracts a lot of attention.
You can't in the lower 48.
You can't just go run a snow machine across, most parklands or refuge lands without some kind of special, unless there's some kind of special allowance. But in Alaska, it's across the board. It is open until closed, and it's only closed for very specific reasons with a very specific public process. And you can't just do it randomly. So there's a bunch of those. And then there's a big one for access or for transportation and utility systems, things like transmission lines, pipelines, the big stuff. And that provision has been used in Alaska to provide things like transmission lines, and cell towers, you know, building cell towers in wilderness areas, things like that. So adequate and feasible access to inholdings. There are millions, 19 million acres of non-federal private land, native corporation and just regular people's land inside these areas, and they have very special access guarantees to their property that the Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service have to provide.
All right, thank you. I want to get Tom in here for a moment. Tom, Sally mentioned inholder issues. So let's talk about those federal inholders. You focused on the Pilgrim family to tell that story. Give us a little snapshot of that.
The Pilgrim family owned an old mining claim well inside Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, and Papa Pilgrim famously ran his bulldozer in to open up a road and get himself access. You know, I think for me, one of the great paradoxes of Anilka was that declaring things protected land to be protected wilderness kind of, in a way, did away with the classic sense of wilderness that had sort of predated Anilka and predated national park boundaries. And so there was a feeling apart from the industrial concerns about the conservation bill was that it was going to drive the trappers off the land, and the people who were going out to build cabins in the woods would no longer be able to do that. And you know, some of those arguments in the present day can be specious, but there is a real sense that there was a historical shift that came that was you know, that was the Yukon River communities that John McPhee wrote about, and as well as the people in McCarthy, the ghost town out there that was trying to adapt its lifestyle to being in the middle of a national park. And so that was a big part of the shift that Anilka brought to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to an email here. Carrie Watson wrote in. She says, my father, James S. Watson, was supervisor of the Tongass National Forest when Jimmy Carter proclaimed more than 2 million acres outside Ketchikan as the Misty Fjords National Monument. So this talk of Alaska is bringing back memories of that time when I was in high school in Ketchikan, my father often playing host to congressional members from various states who ostensibly needed to see the portion of the Tongass to aid in their decision-making. Dad said most of them just wanted a free fishing trip. She says, I remember the discussion leading to regarding the borax mine exploratory phase located in what would become the National Monument, and contentious meetings with concerns that land was being locked up and would no longer be available for resource extraction versus that land needed to be preserved as wilderness. She says, while both my parents were Republicans, I doubt either of them had voted for Carter. I recall my mother simply commenting on what a nice, decent man President Carter was whenever the subject of him came up. I now wonder about my parents' perspective today on Misty and Jimmy Carter's legacy if they were still alive. Thanks for the show. So in just our couple of minutes that we have left here, it's probably folly to even ask this question because it's a big one. But Pat, before Anilka was enacted, you worked on the Native Land Claims Bill and Alaska land issues called D1 withdrawals. Those lands have been in the news recently, but for Alaskans unfamiliar with that term, describe what the D1 lands are and what the idea was for creating them, how that led to the larger legislation.
Well, ANCSA contained both 17D2, which was the withdrawal of up to 80 million acres for study for new conservation areas, and D1, which was other lands, and it was a separate withdrawal. It had some exceptions to it. I believe they were continued to be open for, quote, metalliferous mining locations, but they were essentially closed to state and native selections and other kinds of land dispositions. Those lands, some of which became part of new national parks under Anilka and refuges, some of which remained under BLM land management and were then studied by, over the years, even recently, BLM studied those lands as to what their final disposition or management should be. And within those studies, some lands were recommended for continued protection. Some lands were recommended for release. And under different administrations, they were proposed to be taken out of federal protection and available for example, state or native land selection. And that those land plans and the disposition has been controversial right up to present time. The state, for example, has long argued that they should be the D1 lands withdrawal should be eliminated and available for other uses and including state selection. Others have argued strongly that at least some of those lands are important natural areas and warrant continued protection under BLM, continued BLM federal management. I think this is going to come more to fore here with the incoming administration and see what happens to the disposition of some or all or most of those so-called D1 lands.
And we only have a couple of minutes left here. Joe, does AFN have a position on that, on the D1 lands issue?
I don't know that we specifically on that most current issue. Our priority has been protecting our way of life. So the subsistence is always our number one issue. One quick comment as we wrap, I guess, is, Anilka exists because of INCSA. INCSA exists because of industry and the fact that there was actually people here before industry was here. And the Tongass was taken from Teddy Roosevelt and INCSA we're talking about, but it still isn't, still a work in progress, because I'm glad Ketchikan was mentioned. Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Tanaki, and Haines were all left out of INCSA. So the settlement isn't quite settled yet. So there's a lot of unfinished business, I guess, from the Alaska Native community on a number of these issues. While we celebrate, we're also looking forward to pulling together and getting work done no matter what administration we're working with.
All right. And Sally, in just about just a few seconds here, you're retired from being the state Anilka coordinator, but you're still conducting Anilka trainings. Who are you training?
Hopefully everybody. we do trainings that are hosted by the Institute of the North. There's a few of us there. We're all retirees, federal and state retirees that have worked in Anilka for many years, and Pat's on the team. And so we train many people. We have when we're working on developing an online training that anybody can take. It's not just the feds that need training, state, Native corporations, the general public, NGOs. There's so much loss of knowledge about Anilka, and we're trying to keep it alive, keep that understanding alive.
How many pages is the act again?
181.
Yes, you do need a class to be able to truly understand it. Thank you so much to my guest today in this discussion about Anilka and President Carter's legacy in Alaska, Tom Kazaya, former Anchorage Daily News reporter, Sally Gibbert, former state Anilka coordinator, Pat Porchot, former state lawmaker who worked for Interior, and Senator Mike Gravel, and Joe Nelson, co-chair of AFN and president of Sea Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.